SR Motion Podcast with your hosts, Michael Steinberg and Andrew Hogue.
Welcome to the SR Motion Podcast. Oh man, today is a great day here with co-host Andrew. How you doing, Andrew?
Not bad, not bad. It's a rainy day here in New York, but excited to kick off this convo.
Yeah, me too, me too. Well, for everyone listening, I'm sure you already know this, but this is a podcast where we go over everything AR, VR, motion graphics, 3D, metaverse, whatever that is, NFTs, all of it. We dive deep and we love to explore and learn. So yeah, today's episode, we're going to jump right in. We have an amazing artist. He does just, man, we were looking on Instagram. Me and Andrew were sending some stuff back and forth on this guy's work. It is incredible. We have probably one of the first ZBrush modelers and just sculptors. And we have Bernhard Vanderhorst here. And we are just going to dive so deep into just a great conversation with him. I know me and Andrew are just excited to pick your brain. But anyway, enough with that. Bernhard, how you doing, man?
I've got nothing to complain about. It's my second least favorite day of the week, which is Tuesday. But otherwise... You know, it's better than normal Tuesday because I'm here. So yeah, I'm good, man.
So what would be your first least favorite day of the week?
It's Monday because I'm usually hungover.
It's got to be Monday.
Yeah. everyone will say that, but post alcohol, anxiety, fear, and loathing. So
we all get it. We all get it.
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
Especially post COVID. You know, that was one of those things that really set in. You're like. Well, and I turned 30 during COVID too, so I was like, wow, hangovers are not just about feeling bad. It turns out existential dread is a key part of all of that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I wish I was still 20, man. It was just like, I don't care, I'm just a bit nauseous now. Now it's
what am I doing with my life?
Yeah.
Well, so Bernhard, I gotta ask, just looking at your bio here real quick, it says you're from Cape Town, South Africa, and then you've been in London for the past 20 years. I gotta ask, what is the motion graphic scene, 3D scene? How is that in London?
Massive industry here as well. That said, I'm not that involved outside of my day job at Rocksteady Studios, also in London, and the people I work with immediately, because I'm... with the scene, so to speak, online or on Discord. Not because I don't want to or anything, and I love talking to people. It's just, I'm just so busy constantly making new packs to sell and so on, or working on personal stuff. So I just don't have the time to really interact that much.
I'm going to reel it back actually a little bit here, but so just for anybody listening, do you mind just kind of explaining exactly what your day-to-day is like? Maybe what you would tell people on the street, exactly what it is you do?
Day job or what I do with my personal stuff or just everything?
Let's do everything, man.
I create 3D art, so models, anything from props to characters, creatures, which is my favorite, characters and creatures, preferably stuff that does not exist. Like if I have to make a table that exists, it's kind of, what's the point? Or a normal human being, whatever. If it's something that no one's ever seen before, that really lights my fire, you know? So, and then texture that. So that's my professional job. But on a novice level, like I also rig and animate this stuff. Not for my day job, but for personal projects. So that's it in a nutshell.
Right, and a lot of focus on, you've mentioned your packs. I've had a chance to see them. I highly recommend anyone listening to check them out because it's really highly curated, high fidelity, like super solid work. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very impressive. I mean, and to think that that's not your primary, you know, your primary job, to your point. So in kind of going through that as well, sorry, I also do want to run it back really quickly. So it sounds like from your bio as well, this is like something, you know, it was like 7 years ago that you decided to kind of, to quote you, get off your ass and get back into art.
Yeah.
Which is, again, just to the point of you already have this amazing representation of all these packs and you have a very kind of unique voice and refined style. And seemingly, it seems like it might have come together in kind of a very short amount of time, all things considered. So what was that like? What was it like when you just kind of had that moment of, you know, what were you doing and what was your calling to say, I need to get back to art and dive into this kind of 3D work?
I think the key thing was desperation. I at the time, I was roughly, I can't remember when, but I was so, because I don't play video games at all anymore because I have an addictive personality. But at the time, I was going nowhere, drinking a lot. I still drink, but I mean a lot. I worked at Tower Records in Piccadilly. So it then became a Virgin Media, whatever they're called, Virgin Records. And, you know, I was just getting older and older, going nowhere and doing nothing with my life, knowing I could. And I would run home from work and play Left 4 Dead 1 and 2, like, non-stop. Like, non-stop. That's all I would do. And I was married at the time as well. I would neglect my wife. It was just pathetic. So eventually I just realized I really have to do something. So, and I love music more than anything on earth. That's my main hobby, is making music and doing that. But I know you can't make money with that unless you're really on it. So a friend of mine said, well, why don't you do 3D art? I said, I don't want to. Then I bought a book to study Maya. I don't know if you guys know what Maya is or not.
Of course.
Of course you do. So it was the dumbest way to learn this thick book. And it was really demotivational as well, but I forced myself to learn it. I should have gone on YouTube immediately, but I don't know why I didn't. So I went through this whole book, all the basics and everything. And then I discovered ZBrush and, you know, just forced myself to learn it. And then eventually every night just...
And did you have any previous experience, like growing up, were you into visual art at all? You know, we talked to a lot of people. It's like the number of times I've heard someone is like, oh, I used to make, you know, little doodles in my sketchbooks when I was growing up. And, you know, so that they find that somehow translated into a 3D career or a motion career.
Yeah, that can help a ton, of course. I was fairly adept since I was a kid at painting oil and acrylic, preferably oil, and fine art like pencils and stuff. So doing the same kind of subject matter. But about 24 when I came to London, 23 actually, I just got out of art completely because it was all about music, women, and alcohol. Basically, so
the rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah, it was just like I didn't care for it at all. I just wanted to do music, and
right,
that kind of fades as the more you play video games and just work a shitty job.
Yeah, it can really snuff the spark.
Absolutely.
You know, I also, it's funny, another kind of fascinating thing I found is the number of people in our industry, whether it's, you know, I'm talking 3D general, you know, at its most general, the number of people that are also like, oh yeah, I also do music on the side. Or, you know, there's, which I guess kind of makes sense, right? You've got animation is really just things in motion and timing and pacing, and like really good animation or motion usually is, you know, everyone loves a good cut to the beat, if you will. But it's always interesting to hear people who, you know, my experience is very similar to yours, where it's like I had to make a choice between an industry that I know I would absolutely not make any money at, being music, maybe if I work hard enough, I have a real shot on the kind of motion side.
Yeah.
Mine was stand up, and let me tell you, that doesn't pay anything.
Stand up probably worse.
Oh, really? Wow, man, that takes balls. I was talking to a friend about it today, like how much balls that must take to do that.
Oh man, yeah, it's well, when you drink, you say anything on stage, so it's.
And maybe actually, Michael, that might be the only industry that might be more cutthroat than music. I don't know. I mean, maybe par for the course there, but.
Well, you definitely put your heart on the line, and it definitely takes a little bit of an emotional toll on you when it doesn't go as planned or people just aren't vibing what you're putting down.
Yeah, see, I don't think I could handle, if I ever stood in front of a group of people and made a joke and it was crickets, I would shit my pants and run probably. Like, that would be it for me.
I'd be terrified, yeah.
So, Bernard, one question I did want to ask, you know, I'm much more fascinated by, you know, some of your side work, the ZBrush packs that you've been doing, all your, you know, the creature feature stuff, Insect, which I want to get to, but I am curious, Rocksteady. So I kind of have twofold questions. So, well, first I should say Rocksteady, Batman Arkham Knight was one of my favorite games ever. I just had so much fun with that game. And that was like right when I got back into video games a little bit. I played a lot when I was a kid. So that aside, it's an interesting industry I feel like to be involved with right now. I feel like I don't do game dev stuff. I know people that do game dev stuff. I'm not super close with anyone who is full-time game dev. But I mean, here, you know, in the States, we've heard a lot about these people that are just working wild hours to get game launches done, you know, 100-hour weeks, burnout. You know, I mean, burnout's a real issue for anyone, I think, trying to create for a living, because you kind of have this constant desire to, I got to do more, I have to do more. But
Yeah.
I'm curious just to hear, like, what is your experience as a 3D artist in sort of the game dev space? And, you know, having done some of these personal projects on the side, are there things that you like about, you know, working at Rocksteady that you don't get in your personal work or vice versa, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely.
Kind of curious about your take on that.
I just want to say, I didn't say thank you when you said that was one of your favorite games because I wasn't involved in it. So.
All right. Yeah, no, I wasn't sure. It's a bit old. It's a bit old at this point. So
sure. It's brilliant stuff. I came in afterwards. I've never been treated as well as I have in any job I've ever had as Rocksteady. Wow. Like, we're treated like absolute gold, man. It was like when I joined, just the whole moving process, everything to back to London. I was in Lymington for 20 months, a little break from London for my first game studio job, and they hired me. Just the moving process, how they treat us was just absolutely amazing. I felt, hang on, what's the catch? Like, there's no catch. It was just a really good company.
I love that. But just kind of almost want to ask too, like, because I do want to get into even your personal work the most, because I just love what you've been doing.
Thank you.
But I'm really curious just about your inspiration, and maybe we have to go back to kind of how you got into the field a little bit more. But yeah, I'm just kind of interested in like what made you go down this kind of path, because it has almost like this like gothic kind of dark, a little bit, you know, you kind of mentioned like a creature-esque. I just absolutely love this style you've created. Very unique and very much, you know, you have your own style, which I love.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, if you can,
it's
just
funny because I never see it that way myself. I'm happy when people say that, but I never see it. I guess it's hard to see your own style, you know. But I'm glad to hear that people think that. That's nice. How did I develop it? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Or inspirations. That's always a tough one for me because I'm very instinctive as a person. I'm almost like a mindless animal half the time, just doing stuff from gut instinct, and there's not too much thought. But I can tell you this, I love teeth. I've always loved teeth since I was a little boy. And it started with sharks and dinosaurs. I think that's the root of it. Why? I really don't know. I've thought about this way more than I should. Like, why do I love gnarly teeth so much? Remember Patricia Arquette?
But not necessarily.
She was one of the most beautiful actresses in the 90s. She's still a great actress. And one of her teeth is like slightly skewed. Everyone had a crush on her. And that, to me, just really, really attracts me. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. What does that mean? Freud can probably tell us if he was alive. But, yeah, teeth is, to me, always a focal point almost. Russian artists and Ukrainian artists. And that area of the world, the art's really dark, I find. Like, if I go in an art station, I just happened to notice this by chance the other day. Because I follow a lot of people, at least 2,000 on there. And most of my favorite artists are from Belarus or Estonia or Russia or Ukraine. It's got nothing to do with the current situation, by the way, absolutely fuck all. Just there's something in those people's art that's different than anywhere else, to me at least. It's a darkness, a true darkness of the soul. And I'm not sure what it is, but that's really inspiring to me, very, very much so. Pinterest as well. Just typing straight in Pinterest is such a great rabbit hole to get ideas from other artists or animals, weird animals, insects, spiders, you know? I mean, that's a bit vague, my answer. Sorry about that, but I don't have a specific pinpoint, but it's just lots of stuff.
Yeah. I love speaking about just kind of the, like, Ukraine, Russia, and all of that, you know, and just talking kind of about the darkness. One thing I love about this kind of field and the artwork that's produced of the nature is just, it's like real emotion. Like, you can actually sense just actual emotions from each piece, which is what I just love. It's not blank, it's not just something that's pretty. I mean, it's just each piece, and looking at yours specifically, is just so unique from each other, and each one gives you just a very strong feeling, and it almost feels like there's a story behind each piece. Is that something you ever kind of work into your modeling, where you try and maybe develop a background of where these characters came from? How do you kind of go about developing each piece you make?
If it's like something like Insect or the Creature Feature Packs, there's definitely no thought about that at all. It's just, this looks cool, because if it's some personal stuff, sometimes, yeah. I guess that I subconsciously project a lot of my own feelings, and the darker side of myself whenever you stare into the abyss. That side of everyone has, right? I think that comes through a lot. But I don't, to be honest, I don't really think too much about, I just go. I just, Charlie Sheen, go, one gear, there.
It's interesting to me too that almost all of your work looks like it was developed like very much handmade. It doesn't look like anything is kind of put together through like photo mash or, you know, what do they call it? Turbo squid mashing, where you're just like kind of making compositions with other objects that you buy.
No, I've never, ever used that. I've got nothing against people doing that. I think if you make, if you kitbash, because my stuff is made so people can kitbash, do that very thing. I personally don't use any kitbash only because I have to have every piece of art come 100% from me. And that's not an egotistical thing. There's nothing wrong with doing kitbashing whatsoever. The end product is all that matters. Or end, not product, but piece of art or product. But I just like knowing I made all of that. Of course, the computer helps a ton. Substance Painter does half the texturing for you, but you still need a ton of your own creative eye and mind needs to make the decisions at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, I just absolutely love it. So when you're modeling, are you using primarily ZBrush? I know you mentioned you had kind of started in Maya. Do you actually render out of ZBrush, or are you bringing that artwork into Maya and then kind of making the rendering out of that? What's kind of your process there?
Well, it depends. If it's for the product, the beauty shots, it's rendered in Maya with Redshift.
Nice.
Which I love. It's so fast and wonderful, easy program to just get good renders. But for my Instagram stuff, for quick updates, that's just all in ZBrush with some contrast turned up in the video, you know, quickly. I'm not going to export that and render it in Redshift. That'll take hours for the same video where I'm just tumbling around a model, you know?
Right.
But yeah, Maya is great for everything these days. You can model, do all your modeling in there, but Maya I use for retopology, which is fantastic at that, and of course rigging animation, everything else. And hard surface modeling is fantastic in Maya as well. But sculpting, ZBrush is the king.
So do you, with hard modeling, because I'm kind of one of the new people who are, dare I say, Cinema 4D kind of focused and have been on the little ZBrush bandwagon from the incorporation of Maxon essentially acquiring them. So I've been kind of doing, putting my hand on, well, I have an X-Pen. What's the other one everyone uses?
Wacom.
Wacom, yeah. Essentially the same thing.
Yeah, same thing.
I've been trying my hand at it, and I love it. Now, with hard modeling, I think that's one thing I haven't necessarily tackled. And I think a lot of the listeners are kind of on the same boat as me, just where they're, a lot of people are getting into ZBrush or still had, you know, might not be as nearly advanced as you. Some people just as equal, but I'm personally just questioning or asking. You said hard modeling. Maybe you did some in Maya. Do you prefer to do that mostly, or what? Why would you do hard modeling in Maya versus ZBrush?
I think that's mainly because I've got way more experience doing hard surface stuff in Maya than ZBrush. ZBrush is, these days, it's capable of everything, and I occasionally do hard surface modeling in there. A great workflow these days is you do, let's say a character that's got lots of sci-fi hard modeling stuff on them, right? Hard surface stuff. Just sculpt out the stuff really rough and quickly in ZBrush, and then you isolate parts from there, and you can either take it to Maya and do those parts neatly one by one in Maya or in ZBrush or whatever. There's so many ways to go about it, really.
One thing I totally appreciate about your work is I am not good at organic modeling at all. I feel like I've attempted the sculpt workflow, and honestly, anytime I get to retopo, I'm just like, I don't want to do this at all.
I love retopo.
Really?
Yeah.
What's your, and I know ZBrush has, so I'm a Blender user, which, you know, I will use this opportunity to plug. Blender's sculpt system has gotten pretty awesome. But yeah, the retopo thing, I just never, you know, there are a few different tool sets, a few different workflows, but from what I understand, ZBrush, I think, has a good quad remeshing workflow, maybe.
If you can automatically Z remesh, it's called, and it
right.
But you can't really use it for production at all because it'll have spirals and it won't have optimal flows for animation. You can use it as a base most people I know, including myself, just prefer go into Maya and re-topologize with quad draw. It's beautiful. It takes a long time, but I find it very relaxing, just like UVs.
Oh man, God, you're cut from a different cloth. UVs are another one. I'm like...
But in Maya, they're a pleasure because there was a plugin called Nightshade ages ago, and they acquired it, so it's part of Maya now for years. And
so
it's fun,
and it's funny you say that because I just saw a Twitter thread today. I've not used Maya. I've never really touched it. I've touched Cinema a little bit. I've dabbled around in a few programs, but Maya's one I haven't. And someone was there was this thread that was just talking about how amazing UV mapping is in Maya. I'm not sure why, but
it's incredible. I mean, Maya's not the be all end all. It's got its flaws as well. I mean, Blender is so much better in so many things now. It's really an amazing program now. Like, if I started 3D now, I'd start with Blender immediately and not Maya. But I would still learn ZBrush though, because even though you can sculpt in Blender, it can't deal with too much. The high poly count.
Oh yeah,
and some of the specialist brushes are not up to scratch compared to ZBrush, but it's still very, very good.
And in the same way that as soon as I like discovered like the Substance workflow, you know, and actually Substance just released a direct integration for Blender where you're basically like loading SBSRs or you know your anything you're doing in Designer, you can load it directly into Blender without doing the round trip, export in FBX.
Yeah.
Do your painting and stuff. So that's really cool. But I mean, they wouldn't have done that if I think it was pretty obvious that texture painting was not it still really isn't a strength of Blender's. And like, once I discovered the Substance workflow, I was like, oh man, this is, you know, to be able to just to pull out your stylus and just paint and you've got, you know, all of your maps being painted at once and, you know, really.
And
cool
it actually
stuff.
Works. These link ups are often glitchy, I heard. I've never used any of them.
Yeah, so the SBSR thing is basically it's just like a panel in the material editor in Blender. You navigate to an SBSR and then it loads it up. You know how like in Substance Player where, you know, you have the fields, the parameters that you set when you build a material in Designer and you can say roughness values, base color, glossy color. You know, you can define those parameters and it just basically populates in fields in Blender and you can just apply those materials directly in the node editor, which is a really nice quick way to get something. And I think Substance materials are some of the best for sure.
They're lovely.
Do you use Substance Painter a lot on any of your models?
Yeah, I love Painter. We use it at work. I don't use it for my packs, of course, because that's just high poly decimated sculpts for people to kit bash stuff together. But Yeah, I use it all the time.
Funny enough, just talking about Blender and typology stuff, getting down the polygons, like, it's really fascinating because I've never really looked into how much time that saves. And it really is something that I kind of noticed to be important because I just saw, funny enough, a video. I think it was actually released last year, but it was Ian Hubert. I don't know if you guys know the name.
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenal Blender artist. I mean, it looked like he essentially made this like cyberpunk mono pod racing video. It was something it looks like would take just months to render out. And he was just showing how well he modeled because he had a video game background. So he was just showing how he really focused in on having as few polygons as possible in order to get his renders out quickly.
Oh yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Unbelievable. It was just something I've never really took into consideration. You know, I've kind of just been like, that's okay. You know, maybe I'll cut some stuff out if I need, but just seeing how fast his renders were, he has some great stuff. Just want to give that guy a shout out. That was just something
I'll check him out. I don't know him, but I bet you if I see his stuff, I will.
And I feel like he's like OG Blender. Like the number of things that I've picked up from his YouTube channel, I mean, it's just a wealth of knowledge for sure. And actually, to your point, that was one of the most intriguing parts of when I first started doing. So I would, you know, model and render and every light render, rig, animate in Blender. But I definitely felt like my texturing stuff could have used, you know, a little extra finesse. So when I got Substance, you know, this whole concept of like exporting a high poly model to build your displacement maps off of, and then bringing that back in and then applying it to a low poly model with, you know, now Blender has adaptive subdivisions, so you can actually do true vector displacement.
Right.
I didn't realize how frustrating, and I'm looking at your work now thinking like, I don't know what your viewport FPS is, but there would be times early when I first started working in Blender and I didn't really understand this whole idea of optimizing your models and how much better that makes the creating experience when you're not sitting there trying to like turntable your model and your entire computer is just like 2 FPS.
Oh, I can't work like that.
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. So yeah, do you have any, I mean, I know ZBrush, obviously, I think it sounds as though ZBrush is more optimized for that kind of workflow, but any hacks that you have in kind of approaching projects like that in order to keep the creative flow going and not limited by sort of the tech side of things?
Yes, get a strong computer, basically. Because in ZBrush is a really special program. I don't know, I forgot what it's called, but it's slightly a different way of rendering 3D. Some people might hear this and winch, and it might not be true, but I think so. That's what I can handle. Millions and millions of polys smoothly, and you can sculpt on it in Maya and so on. That comes to a standstill. So I just simply don't work with high poly meshes in Maya because there's no need to, you know. And if you need to retopologize it, you would decimate it as low as you can in ZBrush until you see you lose detail, then go back a little bit.
Right.
If you need to retopologize it in Maya. But I mean, there is no real way around that sluggishness except for a really fast computer that specific process.
After you decimate your model, sorry to interrupt, but do you ever like go back and then do another layer of just kind of cleaning up polygons, or do you just kind of use just decimate and you're like, that's good enough, that's where
that's only for the high poly.
Yeah, okay.
The low poly will be cleaned up more cleaner than my bathroom, which isn't really a great analogy because that's not something that's really clean.
And as a game, you know, working in game dev, I would imagine, you know, that is an aspect that I do not consider, because if I, you know, I get to the point in projects where I'm like, okay, if it's too high poly, you know, I have a pretty, I just updated my rig last year. You know, I've always, to your point, you kind of make it a priority to say, all right, this is just part of the job is, you know, I'm going to have to spend a few $1,000s every year to keep this thing up to snuff. But I'll just get to a point where I'm like, if it's too high poly, I will do what I can to work on it locally. And then I'm sending it to a render farm anyway. I don't need to worry about load times. I don't need to worry about, you know, asset optimization in terms of like an end user actually loading these assets in a real time environment. I would imagine that as a game, you know, working with your background in game dev, that just kind of comes more naturally.
Yeah, and that's paramount. You have to do that. Otherwise, the game will run like crap and no one's going to enjoy it. So things are really, really fine-tuned, optimized. The amount of materials you've got in the model makes a big difference. I'm not sure if it does for rendering, but yeah, get it as low poly as you can, even for AAA games, because it all adds up in a scene, you know? But in my personal work, I'm not nearly that specific like yourself. Things are way more high poly with my cinematic rendering stuff, because I want them to be more high poly, and I don't really care that much.
Right.
Because it's not real time.
So I feel like you might also have some unique perspectives in terms of Unreal Engine is having like a whole, I think we've probably all seen the demos that are just, you know, I've been referencing this, that Subway demo that came out, I don't know, last month or, you know, a month and a half ago, that was a mix of poly scanning, you know, or cam scanning, real-time environments, bringing it into Unreal.
Hyper realistic.
Yeah, wild, just wild. You wouldn't know it's a demo until they do like the night day toggle and like a single, you know, switch. So from your perspective, kind of being in that world a little bit, what do you think about where these game engines are going? I mean, there's obviously use cases, you know, in the VR AR space, in these sort of like building these really immersive environments. For the future of that kind of stuff, you know, what do you think the advantages are to 3D artists? You know, someone like myself who's not doing game dev stuff, I think we're starting to see more use cases for game engines. Can you speak to that a little bit? Or,
well, I mean, that's been the main thing. Hasn't it been for Unreals, like video games? I think, don't quote me on that. So it's always geared towards that, I'd figure. I think the main thing is just things are going to look just way better and we'd have to optimize less and less. That said, I thought that maybe 5 years ago, but it's still the same amount of optimization. You think, oh, well, it's not really advanced that much. I don't know, maybe it's because of consoles, I'm not sure. Processing power of consoles always has to be considered first, whereas PCs can be more powerful. So, but where it's going, I have no idea. The singularity in 2045, I suppose, where everyone just goes, game, make, and it's done, you know.
Right.
And it looks amazing, and it's hyper-real, and it's just, yeah.
I've got to ask, too, with I kind of have a question about your PAX really quick. Man, I can't comprehend how good your stuff is, and I'm very excited to buy some.
Buy.
Yeah. These are just so good, and they're just so well done, and I love how there's just a plethora of options for each thing, whether it's, you know, I'm seeing tails, I'm seeing arms, and it's not just like one, but it's multiple versions of kind of the same thing, which is what I like, because you can kind of make creatures that live in the same world, you know, which is beautiful. One, what was it like starting to produce art pieces like this and then put them on the marketplace? Like, what has kind of your experience been with that? Have you noticed like more growth? Has it been something where you look to making that a hopefully sustainable business? And then two, how long does it usually take to create your packages? Because they're just so well put together. It's kind of shocking how professional these are.
Thank you very much. It's been going really, really way better than I ever imagined it could be. When I started in making the packs in February 2019, I thought, well, what can I make? I'll make, what does people not want to make over and over? Teeth. So I thought, I'll make teeth, you know, like just human teeth. I thought I was going to make that and sell it for $4. So I looked at the marketplace and I saw, is there any other just high-quality teeth? It wasn't really much on ArtStation, my main marketplace, find out money-wise. And I saw one guy had a pack of 30 animal jaws, really, really nicely sculpted. And I thought, well, I'm going to make 33 animal jaws and I'm going to charge $20. So it just started from that, and I thought it'll be really awesome if I can make, hey, maybe an extra $500 a year, you know, at the time.
Yeah. And what's amazing, too, is you think about, like, if you look at what any of these apps that we use to create with, if you look at what they're doing to continue to add value, it's always partnering with other, you know, smaller companies and bringing in content that they're creating. Like, here's a bunch of alpha, you know, certain programs ship now with, like, here are a bunch of alpha brushes. You know, even if you look like Substance, right? Like, someone made all of the alpha brushes for Substance Designer, right? Someone made the seamless textures for all of the different patterns you can load up. So it's really cool to see that you're kind of, I feel like you're really hitting that niche of, like, one, I think that, again, very specific style. Like, to Michael's point, everything lives in one universe, but it's also just really well curated. And to your point, it sounds like your approach being, you know, what are the things that artists have to do over and over again that no one really wants to be doing? Teeth, mouth, torso, tails, you know, all that stuff. And what I'm really blown away by is this bounce between your organic models and your hard surface stuff. Because, like, I typically see someone as, I'm a hard surface modeler, that's what I do, I do it well. I'm an organic modeler, that's what I do, I do sub-D workflows and that's what I'm good at. I'm blown away at how, you know, your mech stuff is so solid, but then, you know, same, you know, in the next slide, I'm looking at, like, these really awesome, you know, organic creature feature eye pack or that kind of stuff. So what kind of motivates you to, you know, you hear this, I feel like you hear a lot in our industry about this idea of niching down, right? Like, that's where you're going to find the most success, is like, get really good at one thing. And as a generalist, that's never really resonated with me. But to see someone like you who's able to bounce between these two kind of art forms, if you will, and do them both so well, like, what is your motivation? Is it just to kind of explore new ideas and kind of break up the creative workflow? Does it, you know, does one inform the other? Or
I think the main thing for me is I like both. That's probably why I do both, because I really love, you know, Vitaly Bulgarov, you know him, for example. He's one of my heroes. He's a hard surface artist. He's organic as well, but he's so good. And I'm not nearly close to any of these guys that I look up to, but, you know, one day maybe. Or Marco Plouf, I'm not sure how to say his surname. He's really well known. Plouffe. If you see his stuff, you'll go, ah, he's excellent. He's one of my favorites as well. One day I'll reach that level of style and design, hard surface wise. But yeah, I do it. It's just, I love both. And I don't want to do just creatures, or, because I started as a generalist as well, learning everything. That's why I know some rigging. And I actually did animation at college for 2 years when I was like hand drawn animation when I on, you know, the old cell page for page. Yeah.
Wow. Classic. Hated it. Oh, man. The roots of animation.
At first it was cool, then you're it's so much work for to get a second.
Oh yeah. Cell animation is always.
But I love animation now. But it gave me a really good background for the 12 principles and animation and so on. So I can animate. But yeah, I just do all these different things. I like it. I love it. And I want to, you know, push myself to. Basically, character art is my favorite art. And that combines everything right, organic and hard surface, usually. If it's sci-fi.
I'm looking at Marco Plouffe right now.
Which one are you looking at?
Adventure Time Cyberpunk.
It sounds like the most amazing thing ever.
It's incredible. Earthworm Jim, The Mandalorian. Are you kidding? This stuff is incredible, dude.
But I like his personal stuff the most. He's just he's serious sci-fi.
Well, no. So these are just mashups. So I think you know. So I've definitely seen the Adventure Time Wastelands like fan art, right, where he takes characters from Adventure Time, makes them in this like hyper realistic.
I have
a BMO render, you know, like that's Adventure Time my jam. But yeah, no, this is it's incredible. But I mean, don't sell yourself short, man. I feel like you're pretty close there.
Yeah. Nah, thank you. No, I know these guys have got a level of finesse that I will eventually get to. I'm not bothered, you know. I'll get there. I'm in no rush.
Well, I want to ask because I think this is probably one of the most difficult things that I think most artists we've talked to have. And that's just knowing when you're done and knowing when the project's complete and when to put it out there.
I usually know it's done. Again, it's my gut feeling. If I look at, let's say, because I'm working on some demonic heads right now. And if I usually zoom out a lot. And first I turn on the flat material in ZBrush. So it's just a flat, there's no details. So if a silhouette looks cool, okay. Then I turn it on the basic material, which is just a standard grayish material. It doesn't accentuate anything. It shows you what you have. If I look at that slightly zoomed out and I don't winch at anything or cringe, or then I just done. You know? And I know I've done the tertiary detail pass, which is usually always the last step. And I would do like 40 heads for a pack and then go through them again one by one, do their final detail pass. And I just know, you know, I don't have words for it. I can see it looks like shit, whatever it may be. And this needs to get deleted or changed.
So you don't necessarily go into a pack creation by saying, I'm going to have X amount of heads, right? Like you might just go in and say you do 50, but then after you do that secondary or tertiary pass, you might delete, you know, 5 or 10 and say, oh, they didn't make the cut.
It used to be 33 as per that very first model. All of it offered that. Well, most of them was 33. I just stuck with that.
Some are
40. it's stupid, but I stuck with it. But the stuff I'm working on now, like Insect, is very different than all the other packs because that's a really focused, self-contained universe where, like, I've got different arm packs and leg packs and so on, right? But they're not of the same specific aesthetic, like where Insect is contains everything, legs, arms, heads of insectoid creatures, and they all fit together aesthetically and so on. That is different. I can't remember how many parts of each. I think I worked till I just couldn't anymore with that one because it was going to be way smaller initially, and then I realized if it's going to be a master pack, it needs way more parts for people to find it useful. Otherwise, all the different combinations, there won't be enough combinations. So I made a lot of parts.
And I mean, 150 base parts plus 127 variations on top of that. That is...
Yeah, that's usually poses of that.
Simple math. What is permutations and combinations? So what, 150 times 127? Is that what the... is that what the math would be? So that gives you 19,050 variations. Jeez. From a single pack.
That's amazing. I need to know, because for me, one thing is if you were to tell me to make three, I don't know, robots, you're going to have three really different looking robots. Do you have any kind of tips and tricks to keeping everything in the same kind of world, or is it just something where you've developed your own natural style where if I'm going to make 50 tails, they're all going to kind of have this look that I've developed?
Well, I think it's both. So let's say you mean like if you're going to make three robots, just for your own personal joy or for a pack?
I think even in a pack, like, I guess one thing I'm curious about is, do you kind of roughly make 50 tails and then, or do you kind of like perfect one and then use that as a basis for every, all of your
rough
other
cuts
ones?
First. It's always rough cuts. But with tails, I literally come to a point sometimes, usually at about 25, where I don't know which tail to make next, because I just make the generic stuff first. Alligators, lizards, etc. You know, any tail I can possibly think of. Donkeys, a devil, a cliche devil tail. So they're all very different, but they look the same because they're in my style. But to back to your question about robots, if you want to have, like, apart from your own style to keep it cohesive, you can make up rules. Rules is a great way to limit yourself in a good way. Everyone teaches that nowadays, but I learned it from Trent Reznor, who's my second favorite artist, musician. You must know who Trent Reznor
is. Nine Inch Nails, we were just talking about this before.
It used to be my favorite band until about a month ago.
Well, because I listened to some Blood Serpent before we jumped on as well. So,
right.
and I was like, honestly, it's the closest reference point I can give you is Nine Inch Nails.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, all that stuff's a bit wank at the moment. It's old demo. My favorite band's from Brooklyn, where you guys are. It's Typo Negative.
Hey, okay. We'll have to check them out. Or I probably heard them.
We gotta get you over here then. You gotta come over.
He's dead. He's dead. Pete Steele, he's dead.
No. All right, well, then,
I know.
You know.
90s band.
Maybe don't come for the band, but you know, you could come and hit up an XR Motion meetup.
I would love New York, because I would guess it's similar metropolitan, cosmopolitan, like London, you know, everything is meh, and just I love cities. But yes, all right, establish rules, like, by broad stuff for robots, for example, it's going to be quite curvy. How curvy will curves be, you know, or will it be quite angular? If you have details, will it be notches that go in a certain pattern usually that are repeated, and so on? You know, make yourself a little, you don't have to, but I think I could work, it usually does work quite well.
That's great advice. Yeah, because that's definitely, I think, one thing for cohesion. Even if you made some bolts or some kind of, just some basic shapes that you were going to use as kind of like as if though the same mechanic was working on the, you know, different robots kind of building in.
So it's interesting, too, because this conversation reminds me, I think about this often. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Gleb Alexandrov. He runs Creative Shrimp, which, again, Blender Shop. Blender Tutorials, really, really incredible artist. He has a talk, which is I highly recommend checking out. And it's basically the idea is it's distribution of shapes theory. And so it's basically that, like, you start with this giant, like, think of a cube, right? Just a single square, okay? And then you have that as your large detail. And then as you sort of drill down, then you get medium details, which are like maybe smaller blocks or circles placed on that cube. And then within those smaller blocks, and it's kind of very similar to the workflow you were just walking through, where you do this primary pass, secondary pass, you know, tertiary pass. Your first pass, you're looking at silhouettes, you're looking at like very broad shapes, you know, and then as you sort of drill down. But he does, in this video, he does analyses of like really good 3D art, and he kind of does these color overlays where it's like, these are the big shapes, these are the medium shapes, and these are the tiny shapes. And it seems so simple, and it, you know, when you watch the video, you're like, oh yeah, I could do that. And then, you know, it all goes out the window as soon as you sit down and start creating.
That is so important.
It's an incredible way to approach art. And the second that I learned that and I was aware of that, when I started looking, honestly, I can pull up your art and you know, any of the packs that you place, it's like you can see that idea of starting broad, drilling down into detail, so that if you're looking at an image 50 feet away, your eyes, you know, to your point of a silhouette looks good, right? So you're drawn in a little bit closer. Yeah. And then, you know, but also keeping people's vision interests by drilling down to the details and seeing these like fine, you know, little ridges and nicks and nooks and crannies and all that. So I think that's it's interesting to hear it kind of reflected back in this conversation, because it's a very useful way to approach. Again, I don't think I do it as nearly as much as I should, but it's always good to keep in mind.
I always throw stuff like that. I haven't always, but I would say in the last few years, always, like, I don't ever not do that. I think it's absolutely crucial to have your primary shapes, get them right, then the secondary shapes, like, and make sure the tertiary details is only a small percent. Well, it's hard to explain it now. I'm terrible at explaining some stuff. But a lot of 3D artists, when they start, They want to put detail everywhere. The whole model. Let's look at some robots, for example. It's just Greeble. You know what Greeble is, right?
Yeah, of course.
Like, it's
yeah.
just Greeble all over the model. And that's like, no. Never, ever do that. It should be focused in certain areas, and it will just look immensely better. It doesn't matter what you're making. Like, in between joints, there's tons of detail, and then there's this broad open surfaces, which makes your eyes rest, and that is so vital with any piece of art. You need rest.
Absolutely, and guides the eye. So when you hit those blocks of, you know, a broader shape that doesn't have a ton of detail, your eye is kind of carried along looking for that next patch of detail where you can kind of have something, you know, visual eye candy, if you will.
Yeah, I've never thought about having that with detail, like using kind of, because I, you know, I feel like most people in our field already know, like, you know, you have kind of the hierarchy of design where you need your eyes to kind of follow down certain paths and to have those breaks. But I've never thought about doing that with details in a 3D model as well. That's really interesting.
No, I can't recommend it enough. It will just elevate stuff immediately. I mean, of course, let's take someone's face, for example. You will have skin detail if it's like a really high def model, all over the model, of course. But I'm talking about the detailed level just above that, you know, clumps of, like, around the eyes, you'd have more wrinkles and so on. That's like the tertiary. You won't have all those wrinkles all over the face. That'll look weird. Unless it's an extremely ancient man or woman, you know. Well, it's like 120, but you know what I mean? It's
of course, yeah.
You've got these islands of detail, of noise, so to speak. It's the same in music as well. It's the same in books. It's all the same rhythm. It's all about rhythm.
Yeah, so it's a self-repeating pattern in the stuff that we find pleasing, for sure. I have an incredible book that I look at very often. It's called The Geometry of Design, and it's basically applying current design principles, looking back hundreds of years, thousands of years, looking at ancient architecture, looking at how a nautilus is formed, and this idea that there is sort of a pattern that you can follow. I mean, I think breaking the rules is also important. I think that's...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But know them first, always.
Yeah, know them first, for sure. So I kind of want to take a broader step here, because I think another thing that, looking at your art station, and you even mentioned earlier, you didn't anticipate your packs to be what they've become.
Not at all.
I think one thing people in our industry are very interested in, I hear a lot of people talking about it, you know, Haley Atkins talks a lot about this kind of this idea of, like, building, you know, building your brand or building your community or you know, anything in that kind of realm. You know, it feels like you have built a very, you know, on in your art station, looking at how many people follow you, you know, how successful your packs have been. When you first started out, I'm sure it might have been a little more vague, but now that you're further along the journey, what was it like building a community? I'm sure you have repeat customers. I'm sure you have people that are, like, anxiously awaiting, you know, the next pack drop. Is there a methodology to that, or is that something that sort of just came organically to you?
I think it came organically in my case. I really didn't expect any of it, but it's not like, I think the majority of customers are silent, but there are some, you know, silent and hopefully happy, because the reviews are usually happy. So, but the people who are always commenting on blog posts, it's not a lot of people, but it's always great to hear from them and to see that they're excited, even if it's one person or 20, you know, it's cool. It's like, oh, someone actually cares about this. And that's a good feeling. But it was all organic. I do marketing occasionally, in quotation marks. Like, it's basically posting stuff that's meant to look like an advertisement on Instagram. So it's nothing professional. It's just, it's not like going on paying Facebook ads, or maybe I should try that.
Instagram ads do work pretty good, I'm not going to lie. I'm just low key.
Okay.
Michael has managed to build. We went 2 years ago. There was no one. I don't want to say there was no one at the XR Motion.
It was
a few
of us. We'll see.
Every single time we go, every single time we host these meetups now, people come in and they're like, "I literally saw this Instagram ad today, and I decided to show up." Which I, wow. You know, and this is someone who I've worked in marketing. You know, before I was full time freelance, I was, you know, primarily in house marketing. So I'm very disillusioned with marketing. I don't like it. I think it's mostly garbage. And so I don't usually, I'm the first person to be wary of it. But yeah, no, I mean, not that you need it. I mean, it, again, the reason I asked that question is because I might be supposing too much here, but I think it kind of plays into this idea. It's like you really seem to have gotten on this journey of building these packs because it's obviously something you're passionate about. It's something that comes natural to you. It's something that the aesthetic is pleasing to you. You know, I don't want to, you know, say that you're only doing it because you like to do it, but it, you know, this idea of finding your voice and sticking with it, not for any reason other than it's kind of what you feel like doing, that can kind of be the best place to be as an artist.
Yeah, that's certainly a big part of it, is feeling fulfilled because it's something I am making a success of, you know, and I built this because I was financially and job-wise, I was frankly a loser most of my life, there's nothing wrong with these jobs, I want to make this very clear, but for me, being capable of more was the thing I was wrong about. I was doing a labor and construction for 2 years, then retail, then a warehouse. I was working for 9 years distributing vinyl, and which was cool people, but we were working in a warehouse. And I was just, I want to do something that I'm proud of. So the money's great, but it's also a self-fulfillment. Just feeling fulfilled at what you're doing. I think that's the main stuff. And it's enjoyable, you know. I love sculpting very much. It's just so... It still amazes me we can do this with our technology, even though we've had it now for 20 years, ZBrush, or 23 years, actually.
Damn, is that how long ZBrush has been around?
98 or 99, yeah.
Wow.
Now, that's what you said, Maxon earlier acquired them. I forgot to tell
you.
Yeah,
they did.
Us ZBrushers, who've been using it for a while, we're heartbroken and still are a little bit.
Oh, I can imagine.
Okay, so I want to know, because I'm not going to lie, I bought everything from Maxon, the Maxon One package. I literally said, I'm never using Maxon again. And then they acquired ZBrush and they were like, it's a part of the package. I was like, great. Well, you know what? Okay, fine. I'll try it for another year. But I have been so curious to hear what a ZBrush artist thinks about it.
Yeah.
What? Please tell me everything you're thinking about that acquisition.
Okay. First of all, I have nothing against Maxon. I'm sure they're a great company. I've never used Cinema 4D, so I don't know them at all. Like, I can't say anything. And there's nothing wrong with buying something. You know, I'm a capitalist myself. I sell packs, so they're from a capitalist, right? So I just want to get that out of the way. It's just, and us ZBrushers, prior to the acquirement, were spoiled, basically, because we were so used to it being free updates for 22 years. It was just free. You bought it once. So an American client and friend of mine who lives in the place where they filmed Jaws, actually, I forgot the place's name. He bought ZBrush for me as a gift because blah, blah, blah. And it costs like $800. But you paid it once, not every, you know.
That's it.
And I've had it for...
Perpetual license.
Since 2016, so that's 6 years now. So that divide 800 by six is not very much. So that's it, really. That's the only thing that broke our hearts. Now we're going to have to stop paying. Well, I'm speaking for myself.
Yeah.
This is 100%, like, as a Blender user for over a decade now, and literally my rationale for using Blender was because it was free, right? This idea of open source software, I feel this way about Adobe a lot. I think Adobe's been doing a lot of acquisitions recently where I feel like, okay, great. I didn't ask for Frame.io in After Effects. I would love to be able to color label my keyframes so that I can have like a visual, you know, I've been asking for that for like a decade. I didn't ask for Frame.io, right? Maxon recently also acquired Red Giant. I had a terrible, terrible experience with their merging, like having to switch from Red Giant subscription. I was basically being triple charged because they tried to port you over to like a new, you know, and then I reached out to Maxon and they're like, well, we typically only will refund the last 3 months or whatever. And I'm like, okay, fine. But like, you know, basically I felt like I was in the hole with Maxon for like $600. And really it's like all these companies that are, you know, that are doing well. Maxon is, I mean, so that's Red Giant that they've acquired. Redshift, wasn't Redshift a recent like merging into the Maxon?
I own Redshift as well, my favorite. Yeah,
Cinema 4D. So, you know, okay, great. If Maxon started with Cinema 4D, I just don't really understand why they think that they would be good at managing Red Giant VFX plugins. Or it just seems like in my mind, I'm sort of like, just stay in your lane. It's, like, don't, you know, because it in most cases, it just seems to not go well. I mean, for at least a few years. I'm sure in a couple of years, everything will level out and, you know, they'll find their groove and stuff. But anytime I hear of these like Adobes or Maxons or anyone acquiring these companies, I'm like, okay, great. Well, that's another tool set that I love that I'm probably going to hate for a little bit because it's going to have to go through these growing pains of having been acquired or... You know,
I know Adobe's got a terrible track record.
So bad.
Well, apparently so.
So bad.
But Painter has turned out pretty well, and everyone was screaming the sky's falling, and I was sad as well. But I was wrong, I guess. It's fine. Painter is fine.
Well, the one thing that annoys me with, well, A, acquisitions, I'm just going to say it's just so funny, because back in the day, it was like companies buying companies. This is... T-Mobile and, you know, AT&T joint. Is this even legal? Like, you know, you remember, like, there was all these, like, court things with, like, company. And now it's just, like, companies are buying up companies left and right. And it doesn't matter who buys what. There's no, you know, what is it called? The competing or anyway. But, yeah, I think, like, just working at a massive corporation, I'm not going to say anything necessarily bad or good, and this isn't bad or good, it's just how it is. But it's just crazy when it gets so big, these companies, and what I think happens at things like
bloated.
Yeah, and there becomes so many levels of processes. To do anything, you have to go through 12 chains of commands, you have to talk to 50 different departments now, and it just becomes, yeah, like you said, bloated, and it just becomes slow. Like I've my old when I used to work at a startup, and my old boss, he was from London, funny enough, and he would always tell me the funniest thing about working at a startup versus a massive corporation. But he was like, you know, when you work at a massive corporation, you almost understand why the Titanic sank. It's like, it's like we see the iceberg, but we got to talk to so many people to take a turn, you know? And, you know, when you're kind of at a startup or a smaller company, you're able to make the adjustments on the fly and much quicker. So that's what I'm scared of, you know, when it comes to like this new wave of just seeing, you know, companies just merging into one now. It's just, I don't think it's going to slow down anytime soon.
Yeah.
But is last thing I want to say, and then because I do want to jump into the future stuff.
I have to tell you something about the Titanic, though. Just one thing, because otherwise I'll forget.
Absolutely.
That was the linchpin. I'm not sure if that's the right word. Why it sank. Because of a single key.
Really?
Single key. Yeah.
There was a guy who was sick when he was working on the Titanic. And they told him, no, get off, you're ill, go rest, you know. On him, he had the key to the only... box with the binoculars.
Oh no. And the guys that were supposed to be,
could you just imagine, just like as the ship's leaving, you're like, oh god.
he did, but it was too late. It was too late, and like,
wow.
So they didn't have binoculars.
They didn't have that in the movie, did they?
And just as a quick aside, this is one of the things I love about our industry, is that at the end of the day, if I'm having a bad day, I can turn it in and say, no one's going to die. No one's dying because I didn't get this project done. It's pretty low impact. I mean, all things considered, you know, I couldn't handle the stress of a job of being like, yeah, you're the guy who's got the key to the binoculars that are going to, you know, I don't want that responsibility.
Yeah, we're artists. We're not that important. We're not doctors or nurses or engineers, or we're the most useless at the end of the day on this planet to make it good.
But definitely the most fun, I would say. Definitely the most fun.
Well, let's go ahead and just jump in, because this has been just so packed with great stuff. And I definitely want to keep this energy going into the future stuff, because I think this is the one thing that makes the podcast different.
The future. Future.
Then this part... hypotheticals, you can talk good, you can talk bad, this is just free range, you know, I flip-flop based on whatever probably you say. If you hate it, I'm gonna be like, you know what, this does suck. I'm just, because it's futuristic, so we don't really know what's coming down the line. But let's just start with, you know, normally this is more of a generalist question, but let's just talk about ZBrush and being on topic with the acquisition. Where do you see the future of maybe like in 4 to 10 years of 3D sculpting and modeling and or with ZBrush? Like where do you see yourself going in that industry as well?
This is one thing. I think I'm in the minority, but I'm frightened because we've all seen Midjourney and stuff, right? And
just got access to DALL-E 2 today.
And it's amazing. And everyone says no, it won't replace concept artists. And you know what? They're right. I just can't help having a little bit of fear, but I hope I'm wrong. Because at the end, let's say you photobash, right? And I'll get to the ZBrush, sorry.
No, please.
It's essentially photo bashing, but just quicker. So it's the same thought process, just slightly different. And I see some of my favorite concept artists using it, but coming up with their own composites afterwards. And it's brilliant.
Yeah, I think, though, I will say just really quick, because I'm, you know, I just got access to DALL-E 2. I've been using Midjourney. Both me and Andrew have Midjourney. Can low-key send you a key if you want to try it, too, if you haven't. But I feel like the one thing that, you know, I remember kind of when it came to, I wanted to be a like videographer, right? And even a photographer. And I was like, once iPhones were coming out so much, I was like, no one's ever going to hire me. But really what kind of started to happen is the quality of our cameras went up more. And honestly, there was just became flooded market with terrible people who couldn't get what they want. And then seeked at even more often and put at almost a higher caliber than what it even was. Because people were like, oh my gosh, like I thought I've been going through all these people that say they can do everything and they can't. And, you know, you try and do like a Midjourney thing, you know, you see like these Nike concept shoes and it's like, okay, yeah, wait until Nike says, make my logo bigger. Now what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, like you can't.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant points, man. And you made me feel a lot better already.
No, and one thing that has really stood out to me, because I'm much more in your lane, Bernard, about like, I feel like I too am like, what does this mean for me? What is this, you know, impact? How does this impact, you know, if COVID taught me anything, it's like, what's the point in planning? But then this kind of stuff comes up and you're like, oh man, like, do I have to pivot again? Like, but yeah. the one piece that I keep hanging on to is that in AI right now cannot make something with intent. There is no narrative. There is no world building. There is, you type in text to a prompt and that's great. And I mean, I think like the Midjourney stuff for me is like, as someone who's an okay sketcher, you know, and I try to sketch things down. I was just talking on a recent episode about, you don't have to be a good artist to benefit from having a sketchbook, because you can generate ideas quickly and, you know, come up with these crude concepts for a composition and get some of the like the work done before you go into the digital platform. And, you know, your time spent in a program on the computer is going to be more beneficial if you have sort of even if it's just a rough game plan, if you're not, you know, you're not a great artist, but you have an idea of a concept. When I look at the stuff that's getting put out, you know, to your point, Michael, first of all, the number of projects that I work, the direct to client projects I work, there is no way that I would be able to iterate on the work that I do in terms of the feedback I get from a client with AI the way it is now, right? You don't get to say, you don't get to type in, okay, I want this exact image that you just created, but I want this Nike logo bigger. Like from what I've seen, that functionality doesn't exist. And two, just to the broader point, it lacks, what is the motivation for the stuff that's being made in Midjourney or in DALL-E? I mean, I think for a lot of concept artists that I've seen using it, you know, creatively, it really seems to just be a starting point that you're going to then take and refine further, which is great. I mean, yes, take out speed up the process for me as a shitty pencil and paper artist. Take out that part of the process that I don't feel confident in, you know, and generate some ideas that I can then spitball on and refine further. But I just don't see it. I don't see it getting to the point. And even the stuff that I've seen on the motion side, right, where someone is taking the motion AI stuff that I'm seeing, is people are animating things and then feeding it into an AI. And then the AI is like stylizing it. It's not, it's not dropping keyframes. It's not going.
I've not seen that yet.
Yeah. There are a few artists that are doing, and honestly, the other thing is it all reads to me kind of the same. All the AI stuff that I see looks the same. There's really weird holes everywhere. There are awkward textures placed on things. It definitely cannot do human beings at all. I mean, there's always just like weird, like a mouth is like sideways, or like, you know, there's one eyeball where it shouldn't be. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, again, it's like, I'm not knocking these things, because I personally find them to be useful. I would, you know, I love
I think they're amazing. Idea generators.
Yeah, 100% idea generators. Now, in 10 years, maybe it is something different, but I just don't think it's, I don't think it's going to ever be able to replace, you know, and this is the overarching narrative of most of the conversations I have with artists in our industry, is that it's about finding the story that you're trying to tell, the voice that you're trying to curate, the, you know, whatever that is. I don't see the AI stuff going that way. And if anything, you know, I mean, I saw Google recently said they have another AI text to image generator that they aren't even letting people get access to, because their primary concern is that people are going to use it to be like Joe Biden running naked at some kids event. And then like, that's going to be like, whatever, you know, I don't know, dude, just
Fox News, you know, you'll see that like the second that's uploaded.
But that's exactly the point. It's like, they're not worried about artists getting replaced. They're worried about like misinformation and people not fact checking the things that they're looking at, you know. So
that was actually the entire thing. So we had to meet with like some Mid Journeys, or with because like DALL-E 2 is like kind of more powerful in some ways than Mid Journey, and it's 10 times quicker. And so today, to get access, we had to meet with some of the staff, and they had to explain their worries and everything. And they were saying like, we're actually in a weird state right now where even artists, like professional artists, are still commenting and saying, this isn't real. There's no way an AI made this. And they're like, you guys literally need to be saying, for the sake of humanity, like, AI did make this, just so there's public recognition that of what artificial intelligence can do right now. Because yeah, that misinformation is so big right now, and people just aren't going to believe, including professional artists, that of what AI is capable of right now. So it is very interesting. But again, I'm not necessarily worried about, because I think like, even if they could make, say, for instance, like 3D characters, like you're going to have to, just going even back to what I said of like developing a world, or, you know, a set or a universe where these characters live in, there's no way to that AI, I think, can't even imagine anywhere near close to making these characters, multiple characters that all live in a world but have different features and stories and attributes. And even if, just again, having to have clients deal with that, they're going to want modifications. And you're just, I feel like what might happen is we're going to get a lot of bad artists that flood the field saying they're artists.
That's a good point.
Clients are going to get super fed up. And honestly, it's going to make people that aren't hard workers join in. And the people that actually are good at putting in the hard work are going to get recognized so much more. And it's just going to put a spotlight on the people that are actually doing work. So, and then, yeah, just again, people wanting something different, like put a backpack on, put anything on, you know, it's just going to take almost more work to try and figure out how to make that work versus just doing it yourself.
It is
just so interesting to be talking, because this is, I think, the first time we've talked about this, me and Andrew have on the podcast. But yeah, it's just like, it is a fun, new, crazy, interesting, who knows what's going to happen, you know?
Well, I think you're right. I think I'm overly worried, because I tend to be with certain stuff that's affecting my livelihood, and then my worry was for nothing at the end of the day.
The more I use it, the more I feel confident, because the first few images, I was just so shocked that it was able to produce an image that was somewhat close. I feel like I'm so good at analogies, I can't really even say it right now, but let's just say like, you had AI that was making a cake or something like that, and you were like, I want a chocolate cake, but it just made like a tiny little cupcake or a cookie, you would just be blown away. And you're like, holy shit, look what it just did. But really, it's like nothing at all what you kind of were.
It's not useful. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the more I keep using it, the more I'm like, okay, this isn't actually getting anything at all what I'm really trying to get. And I've actually not really had any exact results, but it's made things that are completely different than what I wanted and are super cool. But it's like,
right,
yeah,
the more I use it, the more I'm like kind of less intimidated by it.
And like, what's the motivation, you know? What is the motivation for 90% of the stuff that I've seen made with Midjourney? It's because it exists. It's because people are like, I did this with AI. I've yet to see any real utility. I've, you know, aside from being like, check this out, we should all just take a second and be enthralled at the fact that a computer made this. And I think that's really cool. And I think we're going to find ways to use it. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it just doesn't feel like there's a strong motivation for what it does other than doing it for the sake of doing it and being like, wow, that's really cool. And, you know, that compounded with, like, if I zoom in on any AI generated image, I'm immediately not impressed. I'm like, it's just like, it's like a weird blob of, like, I can tell it just went to, like, Google image search and just, like you said, photo bashed everything together in this sort of, like, sloppy mess of, you know, from far away, it might motivate me to be like, oh, that's a cool, you know, composition, or, you know, there might be some design rules, you know, in terms of composition in place. But it would take a human hand at a computer making decisions.
On top of it.
Mm-hmm. On top of it, yeah.
I see it as, like, smart materials in painting. Can't just slap smart materials and stuff and expect it to look good. It will not look good. You need to go on top and add your touches. There's cool examples on ArtStation of, on the blogs, that people show their exact personal processes using Midjourney, and some of it's really cool, and it was really just a tool for them, and they really turned it into their own thing, but it was a very helpful tool.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I'm just going to agree, like, it's, I think it's a tool, you know, I think it's one of those things where, yeah, like you said, Andrew, from far away, it looks good. And then as soon as you kind of click, like, full screen, you're like, oh, like, it's like not that detailed.
It looks like someone just learned how to use the clone stamp tool in Photoshop and, like, really went in on it, you know?
And give that, let's say that's concept, right? Well, it is concept stuff. Give that to the modeler and they're like, what the fuck is this? Like, I can't model that.
Or like, it's like the step before the prime, like we were talking about this hierarchy of shapes, right? I almost see it as like fitting in somehow before the primary pass, you know, where you're sort of like, you get this crude blocking that might have some hints at what the detailing might look like. But again, it's just, it's going to take someone, you know, putting the hours in and making some informed decisions about what they're trying to accomplish with whatever they're creating.
And the most important thing, and I would argue as any artist, is your eye, the eye that you've developed to see what works and what doesn't. And that's independent of tools. You just learn how to use tools, but developing that artistic eye over the years is the main thing that defines you as an artist, in my opinion, making the choices with that artistic eye. And as you said, you will use that eye, I won't say eye again after this, to paint over the concept that was generated. So yeah, it's pretty great. I'm not scared anymore. I feel better now.
Yeah, oh man, anymore. You got to talk these things through. Anyway, we'll charge you $100 for therapy. The therapy session. Yeah, exactly.
And to not be scared to use it. I mean, me 5 years ago probably would have avoided it out of just fear of feeling, you know, to everything we've talked about here, fear of being replaced. But to have a forum, you know, like on our Discord, a lot of people were using it, so everyone's sharing what they're making, and, you know, to have an open conversation about this stuff. And I think, Michael, you've made this point too. You know, I'm sure you've got more stuff in the queue here about, you know, future of where all this is heading. But it is really up to us to have these conversations and to be honest, you know, essentially we're the stewards of whatever is going to come next, because we're going to be the ones using it first. We're going to be the ones that are able to kind of dig deep and, you know, and if we allow the fear of being replaced, or, you know, insecurities about our own careers, you know, if we allow that to guide the conversation, it's probably not going to, it could go better. I would say that.
Well, I do want to keep the conversation going, but just moving on to the next part, because we have two more big questions. Drum roll. What is your thoughts on AR, VR, and kind of the metaverse? Like, where do you see that going, and where do you see potentially yourself being in that field, if at all?
Interesting question. I don't know. My first company I worked for was Pixel Toys. It was mobile games. And they did VR stuff, pretty cool stuff. So I've only used a VR headset maybe 2 hours in my life. And it was cool. That was years ago, so I don't know how good it is now. I hear it's fucking amazing.
A little bit.
If I didn't have such an addictive personality, I would be in a VR headset half a day, just playing. I'd probably be playing Half-Life Alyx.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it is unreal.
Because that's my favorite company, games-wise, is Valve. Half-Life 1 and Left 4 Dead is, but yeah, so I don't know, I don't have much experience to answer that, nor AR. It'll get huge. The metaverse, I mean, it's exploding in slow motion, right? VR, like, it's, everyone said it's going to fail, but it is. It's growing and growing in all applications: medicine, travel, entertainment, education. But the metaverse, I asked one of my best friends the other day, what the fuck is the metaverse? Like, I don't know what it is. What is it?
It's, I mean, honestly, I'll give you two. I feel like I'm always talking about this. I'll say my two answers, and maybe Andrew, if you wanted to expand on it, but I'll say there's, the word hasn't necessarily been defined, but in some people's mind it has. So if people say, if everybody agrees it's something, then maybe it is something. Mm-hmm. But as of right now, Mark Zuckerberg himself says the metaverse does not exist yet. Like, we're not even close. So I think from a technical standpoint, if you talk to like really big VR, XR, AR people, it's supposed to be kind of like the next wave internet where everything is somewhat connected and you can kind of make an avatar and bounce into different worlds using your own avatar and bringing in assets into different worlds, kind of.
Would this be different companies also being connected in VR?
Right, exactly. So like, okay. Facebook is even trying to, they have complete open source over all of their coding and world. Like, Pixar has essentially tried to make a physics engine that also works. It's like Pixar and Apple teamed up to make the physics engine for the metaverse, and Apple's making the open source for it. But my whole thing is like, companies, I mean, guess what? Fortnite and Epic Games isn't on Apple. Amazon has Amazon products. Google Phone Play has Google Play apps, and Apple has Apple apps. Like, since when the hell are, why are we thinking they're all just going to sing Kumbaya together? You know what I mean? Like, they're yeah. going to separate. They're going to have their own walls. Like, you can't come in here with it. But that's, so that's.
Unless.
Yeah.
Unless. It just takes two big companies to form a partnership just with that realm. And then you're cut out if you don't join in, you know?
Yeah. Well, so there's so much to go into. And even with it kind of going into our topic after, which I'll hold off for that for now. But so that's kind of like one theory. That's kind of like, I think, the technical term of the metaverse when Mark Zuckerberg's saying we're not there yet. And you hear people say we're not even close to there yet. Then there's this other world, which is just simply VR worlds being built, and it's kind of like this starting process of just using like VR chat or just essentially just VR and AR online. People call the metaverse, they're like, oh, that's a Snapchat filter, that's the metaverse, you know. It's So I think people kind of look at the singularities of it, and even though nothing's connected yet, they just consider that the metaverse, even though the metaverse is supposed to be when it's all connected. So
yeah,
that's my thing. I don't know, everyone has
that's what I figured broadly, but
well, I think there's also the confusion that I feel like was really spurred, this all got big in the last 2 or 3 years, right? I don't think it's a coincidence that Facebook decided to suddenly become Meta, right? So I've even talked to people completely disconnected from this industry that think the metaverse is Facebook IP, right? Or Meta IP, right? That because it's got Meta in the name, it must be related to, you know, my primary interfacing with anything, you know, metaverse related. I actually had a big dive into The Sandbox, which is basically taking all of what we see on the internet now and bringing it into, yeah, this interactive universe where you've got like, you can go and visit like Snoop Dogg's mansion and he might like put on a concert, or you can go, you know, it's basically brands buying into an experience that they can then, in my mind, it's an extension of what we already have on the internet. You know, it's just, it gamifies like a lot of how people interact with the web now. It rewards people for interacting. And I think there's like some cool things that can happen with that. I also think there's a lot of stuff that we need to be wary of, you know, it, like monetizing everything for the sake of monetizing it, I don't think is the best move. That's just like my own personal take. But I do, I mean, it seems to me to be this intersection of when you have these monopolies on the internet, like think about like how many searches on the internet does Google process in a day? Right? Like probably 90%+. I don't know. I mean, I'm throwing a number out there. Don't quote me on it. But, you know, so now it's like, it's taking everything we've built over the last 30 years post-dot-com boom and being like, let's repackage it and put it into a new sort of mixing it, and obviously the intersection of where crypto is and all of that stuff. I mean, there's, it's definitely, I think you, Bernard, you had a really good way of saying it. It's like exploding in slow motion, where it feels like, a lot is happening, but then also not really a lot is happening, because I think, to your point, Michael, it's like, everyone still has proprietary stuff, so no one is going to be I don't think any of these companies are going to be first in line to say, yeah, let's just open source it for everyone and like not make money on it, off of it. And I think in like 10 years, we're probably going to see like 15 metaverses. They'll probably all be called the metaverse. You know, they'll fall under that umbrella, but I think Google will have one. I think Meta will have one. Sandbox is like completely separate from any of those companies, and they've got one. You know, so...
I think that's what's going to happen.
And it's like crazy too, because I mean, I look at, Bernard, you look at your packs, right? Like you could make an insect metaverse where like you put on a headset and suddenly you're in this world where it's like all of the, how we did the math earlier, what, like 19,000 permutations of your packs, you know, crawling around, and like you can, you know, it's this weird intersection of gaming, branding, marketing, you know, how do companies make money? How do people make money by engaging in this stuff early? I mean, it's really, it does feel like the Wild West. And because of that, it makes it very difficult to predict where it's going to go. But I do think we've passed the threshold of, I don't think it's a matter of if, I think it's just a matter of when and what it's going to look like, you know? And I don't think that I also don't think that necessarily means that us as artists have to do any, you know, I mean, some people will, some people won't. I don't think it's going to become an obligation to be, if you don't do AR, VR, or, you know, there's still going to be traditional media. There's people, I mean, it's, movies haven't been replaced, you know, I mean, there's, people still want to experience things the way they normally have. There's just going to be a whole new industry that grows out of it, you know, in the same way that like 30 years ago, ZBrush didn't exist. And suddenly people were like, oh, I could sculpt for a living. You know, I mean, it's, people will be like, oh, I can make assets in these universes for companies that want to, you know, we have NFT NYC going on, or what is it? NYC NFT. I don't
know. Yeah, no, it's crazy this week.
It's absolutely mind-boggling, because it's just like people lining up in Times Square to see their NFTs like played up on dashboards, which really is no different than like if you were a marketer 30 years ago and you had an ad that played in Times Square, you'd want to go see it, you know. I don't think it's, in a lot of ways, it's not that big of a departure, but there are some, I think there are some barriers to entry for sure in terms of tech. And you know, I'm not big in VR AR. I don't even have a headset, so it's like sometimes I feel a little bit left out of the conversation in that regard, but I still can appreciate it. And you know, I'm trying not to let it impact too much of how I'm doing my day-to-day, if that makes sense.
I don't think much about VR at all, to be honest. I don't have a headset, and most people I know can't spend too long in VR because it's uncomfortable after a while. It makes you feel
sad. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing I was going to ask too is like, so when VR and AR first started coming on the scene, the one thing that really excited me was like, honestly, just modeling in VR. It would be a very different experience than modeling on a, you know, a planar surface on my screen. You know, do you know any artists that, you know, sculpting artists that sculpt? I've seen some people that are like primarily sculpting in 3D. You know, Blender has like a build that is just like a VR AR build where it's like you can throw on a headset and like you're walking around your model like sculpting. And you know, but yeah, I mean, it might be an interesting way to interface with your own work.
I've never tried that, no, but I've seen it obviously, but it could be fun if it, well, kind of feels like clay. That could be awesome, but I've no experience in that, I'm afraid. But it could be quite tiring, because with a stylus, you're just going like this with your pen, right? It's only your wrist moving. Now you're doing this. It's like it's the same thing, like, you know, when Iron Man has got all these high tech. That must be so tiring. Just give me a mouse and my wrist moves.
You know? This is minimal movement right here. This is key efficiency right here.
Yeah.
That's so funny, because Michael, you were just talking on that episode with Justin where we were talking about the idea of using VR to innovate on how people interact with UX UI. But yeah, there is sort of the double-edged sword of that, where it's like, maybe it's just really tiring, you know? Like,
we figured out the most efficient way to move in virtual digital space.
Turns out it's just a mouse. It's just a mouse just or a stylus.
Maybe a little eye tracking could help, you know, so you don't even got to move your hand that much. But
yeah, but if I have to be like walking around and stuff, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it is tiring. It is tiring.
Don't get me wrong, I love exercise and calisthenics and that kind of stuff, but I don't want to do it the whole day.
Yeah, no.
Well, we're going to keep it going, and I'm just going to say one thing. We'll jump into our last question here, but I do want to say, Bernard, I'll probably buy some of your packs if they're efficient for gaming, man. I'm super stoked to try out some of them. Might hit you up after to see which ones we think are best polygon wise, but
oh, for games they'll be terrible, all of them.
Oh, really? So most of your models are like super high polygon then?
Well, they're decimated as much as possible to retain detail, but they're basically meant for the first stage where you put something together and then you will refine it yourself.
You still got to retopo, Michael. You've got to retopo it,
absolutely.
Well, I'm excited just to get them regardless and make some cool renders. I've been just awesome. Obsessed with ZBrush recently.
Yeah,
so.
No, Michael has been, he's been doing his dailies on ZBrush, and honestly, man, your stuff is looking pretty solid. So,
just wait until I get some of Bernhard's assets.
Zero to hero.
People are going to be like, wow! I'm going to say, made it all by scratch. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I'm excited. Check them out. And I'm sure you're going to, anyone listening, you're going to hear me talking about the assets in the next episode.
Awesome, man.
Yeah. But I do want to jump in because this has been just a jam-packed episode. Almost hitting 2 hours here. This is crazy.
Oh, fuck, 2 hours.
Thank you so much for sticking around. But this is the last
one. No, it's my pleasure.
Like, man, I've been loving every second here. But we got to ask, this is like, the big thing in the, I guess, industry, just mentioned on it. It is NFT week in New York City. Coming live at you. Bernhard, what is your thoughts on NFTs? The good, the bad.
The ugly.
The don't know, the do know.
I think it's pretty cool. I think they're pretty cool. I know a lot of people hate them. I think most people on ArtStation are concerned about the pollution side from the machines. I'm not that concerned. I think if Ethereum is the key driver, I think they're working on optimizing efficiency, so I'll be honest, I don't care about that aspect. NFTs I think are pretty cool. The one part of it I like is if you've got a really shitty drawing and it sells for $10 million, I think that's badass because it reminds me of, you know, Andy Kaufman. He was a comedian in the 60s.
Yeah, oh hell my, yeah, that was one of my biggest inspirations when I said I did stand up was Andy Kaufman. Love that.
Oh, so you know, I love that guy. I absolutely adore it. And I love that mindset of, it's kind of mischievous. And a lot of NFTs to me is like that. A lot of it's awesome. And then there's the more serious arguments like, or debates, owning the Mona Lisa versus owning a digital. Why do people want to own the Mona Lisa if you can just get a print of it? Because it's the original. You can get a print that looks exactly the same. It won't have the granular texture if you touch it, but I don't really touch paintings when I look at them. But so it's not the best analogy, but it's similar, you know. Like, why would you want a digital JPEG or GIF that anyone can copy? Because I own the original. It's part of our ego. I personally don't care. I don't buy any art, but I understand that's part of the human psyche to own the original.
Have you made any NFTs?
No, but I wanted to. I wanted to make. I've been looking at this big time because there was a few artists I follow and like on ArtStation who generally work on Hollywood films and so on, and they've got sculpts that they've just NFT-ified. And then I read an article about, oh, and he made $2 million. What the fuck?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, I want to do that too, not because of greed. I don't want money for the sake of money. I want money so I can just do music.
I definitely want money for the sake of money only because... Because money for the sake of money means exactly to your point that I can just, I like, dude, if I could just not have to worry about stuff and just, you know, one of the biggest blockades to, you know, creative block for me usually comes when I'm stressed about other shit, and other shit usually revolves around money or, you know, like, do I have a retirement? Am I ever going to retire? Am I, you know? So yeah, I mean, when NFTs got big, the biggest thing for me was just like, man, it would be really nice to just, you know, every Freelance Manifesto by Joey Kerneman, I don't know if I'm saying his last name right, from School of Motion. You know, he has this whole thing that he lays out in there where he's like, the ideal scenario is that you're getting enough work that pays well, that you can take work that pays nothing but feels really good to make. And so, yeah, I mean, the idea of selling an NFT that makes you enough money that you can just fuck off for a year and make whatever you want. I mean, that is the dream, you know? And
exactly.
more power to the people that have made it work for him.
Yeah, I root for him, man.
I was very late to the game. You know, I felt like I was like, oh, I feel like I know about NFTs and no one else does. Turns out I was like, even feeling like I was early entry, it was like 2 years too late. But
well, everyone's saying the bubble has burst, but has it really? I mean, people are still selling them, right? So what's the deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the long-term thing. I think it might be interesting how it correlates with the metaverse and maybe even being used as some sort of backwards kind of image search kind of filter where, you know, say, for instance, I could see a social media platform going off where you make a meme and you could have that as an NFT. And if you're the original guy who owns it and people want to post it, well, then now you're getting paid for it. Like I was just watching this whole thing about how Elon Musk literally crops out meme creators intentionally every single time. Like he posts a meme, he always covers whoever made the meme.
Really?
Yeah. And like, there's like, wow. I was so blown away. And they were saying it's becoming a meme in itself that he doesn't credit meme creators. And
that's so weird that he does
that. Yeah. This one guy was saying how he's gotten like actual offers for money from like, you know, and there's people like the Fat Jew, these other meme accounts that actually pay him to use his work, but yet, you know, and to reblog his stuff. But then, you know, you're still looking at Elon Musk, who's getting like trying to take the credit as if though he kind of made it's interesting, but I could see something where like an NFT could be backwards traced to a certain account, like sure. Almost like an image verification, or, you know, you try and post even a sound on. I literally today just got flagged on a video I posted. It was like a behind the scenes, just a BTS video, but I used a song and I just got flagged for it today. And they said, "Where no one can see your video anymore because you have this song on it." But I could see that happening with like memes or images. And like, if you own the NFT, maybe there's some interesting like kind of compensation that comes from that.
Royalties.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah. Royalties. Exactly. So that could be a very interesting thing I could see in the future happening with NFT. So I think as of right now, it is kind of like, what do you do with it? You know, I think I love that you said it is kind of like an ego thing, because you're right. It totally is kind of like the main driver right now. It's like, I own it. And then it does make you feel good. And that's what, and you feel like you kind of do own it. And you have a proof of receipt saying you helped an artist. And guess what? Like, I have that proof. You don't have that proof that you helped an artist or that you have that receipt. So
yeah, people like owning stuff.
Yeah, so I think the bubble primarily comes from the hype, kind of, is obviously there's always a hype bubble of like, oh, this is new and shiny. That kind of faded along with there's the double crash, which is just crypto in general crashed hard this month. So
all my stocks crashed a bit as well. Normal stocks, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's just a double whammy, but you know, it is crypto week, so hopefully there's not a bunch of sad people in New York City.
No, people should see all these crashes like this. It's a Black Friday sale.
Exactly.
Unless you're a pensioner and you need that money now, which sucks. But if you're not, this is good. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
In a 50-year investment, generally, in a 50-year of you buying stocks, for example, you're going to go through about 14 crashes.
Yeah,
and
right.
That's about 22% of the time, but 78% of the time your money's going up stock. So
well, yeah, and it's like the irony of the number of times I've been told in my lifetime, all right, gear up for another once in a lifetime financial crash. And I'm like, okay, well, this is at least 3 or 4 for me, so I'm strapping in for like every 10 years.
That's about it. It's about every 10 years.
Buy the dip. That's our podcast. No, I'm just
kidding. Yeah, no. This is, I guess, what's the catchphrase? This is not financial advice. This is
do need to say that.
We have no responsibility for.
I didn't tell you to do
these opinions and ideas are that of my own and do not represent any large corporation.
I will tell you to do one thing, and that is to go and buy some of these incredible creature feature packs.
That is a great investment. That, you know what? Thank you very much. If you want something that holds value,
it's going to pay dividends, people.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. And I am excited about that. Well, I think we just had a phenomenal podcast. So much fun, man.
It was a blast, man.
I normally am getting a little winded there by like a few, you know, an hour in. And just to think like I want to keep talking is insane to me right now. But I don't know if listeners have the same insight, but
I could talk for another 2 hours, but I also need to actually, because it's 2 a.m. here and I got to get up early.
Oh, shit.
No, it's fine. It's not a problem. It's not a problem.
Well, we'll wrap it up here. Bernhard, man, so glad to have you on. Is there any last thoughts or like anywhere you want people to, like projects you're going to drop that you want to say, or social media or anything like that that you want to share?
Ooh, not that I can think of. I can just give advice to people if you want to get good at art.
I love that. That is my favorite thing. If you want to give your last words of advice, or I like to call it pocket advice. I didn't even ask that.
Okay, well, this is, for people who have heard this a million times, but it's the truest possible thing in becoming good at something. Just do it every fucking day till you get good at it. But specifically for art, a specific thing you can do, and this is what took me a while to do, is go to ArtStation, look at the very best artists, put your work next to them, don't kill yourself, but cry, and so on, and then just keep on doing that till there's no more pain and you start getting there. And look at reference, those three things. Look at reference all the time, sculpt or whatever modeling you do or art every single day, and you will suck for a long time, and then suddenly you'll be amazing. And put your work next to the best. And that's about it, really.
I love it, man. Yeah, big round of applause. Hell yeah. That's great.
It's simple advice. I'm sorry, but yeah.
No. It's keep it simple. I mean, that's really what, you know, you can pontificate on it for hours. Obviously, we have. But yeah, it's been a real pleasure having you. And honestly, appreciate so much the time that you've given us. It's 2 a.m. where
you are. That was great, man. Thank you, guys.
and obviously, if you are in New York or if we're ever in London, you know, if you're stateside, we've got pints with your name on it and
absolutely
a whole bunch of people that would love to chat with you, I'm sure. So
100%.
Totally, man. Absolutely. It was a blast.